Welcome to the Legal Moves Podcast. This is Zachary Strebeck. I am your host and the resident game lawyer. Today, I'm talking with Ben Harkins from Floodgate Games. Welcome, Ben.
Hey, thanks for having me here.
No problem. Yeah, this one is like a year in the making. I think we had originally scheduled something a year ago to record, and I think I flaked out or I don't know. And then we never talked after that. But yeah.
I feel it's been a year since there was an actual plan, and about a year before that when we were working on that.
Yep. Yeah, because I think we met, it was about a year and a half ago maybe, at PAX South.
At PAX South a couple years ago, yeah.
We were on a panel.
Yeah.
Did you go this past January?
I did not. I was thinking about it, and it just didn't fit with everything else. But it's a great convention, though.
Me too. Yeah, I loved it. I think I've been to PAX West. I've been to a bunch of different conventions, and I think that it's one of my favorite, just because it's kind of small. You get to meet a lot of people, and there's a lot of more independent developers, game developers, and tabletop developers there. I don't know. It seemed like a cooler vibe than PAX Prime, which was just kind of too big. I don't really care about, you know, going to see Nintendo's booths or, you know, the sort of bigger companies. I like the small stuff. So there's more of that.
Yeah.
Or it's more focused on.
Yeah, I did get the. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And just the people are so friendly and and open to new ideas and just curious about tabletop gaming at this giant, what's effectively only a gaming convention, video game convention.
How about I'm going to PAX. Is it PAX Unplugged, I think, in November in Philly. Do you have any plans to go there?
I was tossing back and forth. I decided to stick with BGGCon this year. I had to pick between the two.
Yeah.
And I decided to stick with that one. I got a lot of friends who will be there, and it's just been a good con for me.
Great.
Historically. But I'm excited to see what they do with it.
Well, I'm from the Philly area, so it's a good chance for me to visit family and all of that. So that's my excuse anyway.
A no-brainer.
Yes.
I like it.
Yeah, absolutely. So why don't we start? I always start by just kind of discussing your background, what you did before starting Floodgate Games and sort of how you got into the games industry.
Yeah, I can. I'll give you a little background. So I've been playing tabletop games pretty much my whole life. Started with the basics such as Monopoly, Risk, chess and so on, if you could call those basics. In my college years, I discovered a game called Acquire, which is a sort of known game that was published by Avalon Hill, and it just really got me excited about like the possibilities of tabletop gaming and whatnot. So I just started getting more and more into the hobby and decided, hey, I like this stuff, and I had some ideas for making my own games. So in 2012, I took a game idea I had and I put it up on Kickstarter because I was also fascinated with the concept of crowdfunding, and lo and behold, other people wanted to fund my idea. So Floodgate Games was born.
Awesome. Let me ask you, I have this question for later, but since you brought it up, so what year was this that you did this first Kickstarter?
2012.
Okay. Wow. So, I mean, obviously Kickstarter is hugely different now, right? It's gotta be a totally different game. Do you like ever think that for a new developer now, it's sort of impossible to really make something on Kickstarter or, you know, how is it different? What do you have to do now?
Oh, that's a big question. I don't think it's impossible. I don't think it's impossible by any means. I think the difference now is there are sort of unspoken rules in a sense that you sort of have this minimum bar to achieve in terms of presentation quality and preparedness and whatnot. And I think as long as you as a new publisher are kind of up to speed on what those pieces are, I think you can still do just fine. You don't need to come into it with a giant audience, but you also need to come in with a pretty like fully formed idea and a good sense of what the art is going to be like. And you need reviews behind you, so you have this sort of social proof that your game is something that's worth the time and attention of other gamers.
Yep. Well, so let me kind of pick those apart. So you don't have to have a gigantic audience, but you have to have some audience, right? You can't just go in completely blind, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You got to have someone.
Oh, definitely.
Well, I guess you also sort of have to realize your limits and set a goal that's realistic, right? You can't set $300,000 goal for a brand new tabletop game. I mean, they may fund and they do fund sometimes, but it's very rare.
Yeah, definitely. Understanding why you are setting your goal to what you're setting it to is very important too. Because, I mean, people sort of raise their eyebrows if they see first time project runner has this giant goal. Uh-huh. Why do you need all that money?
Right.
Exactly. You know, when others can do a project of equivalent complexity for far less.
And also, why should we trust you with that much money when we don't know who you are?
Yeah. Definitely. Definitely. That's been an interesting aspect of Kickstarter, and one that I'm actually surprised now that there's so much money flowing through Kickstarter that they don't implement more of a feedback loop or anything like that into their system. I think it's kind of interesting.
Meaning what? So give me an example of how you think that could work.
One of the things I've thought is you can have, let's say, a first-time project runner. Mm-hmm. You know, they would set their goal of, let's say, $10,000 to publish their game, and suddenly it's wildly successful, and maybe they fund 10x or something like that. Uh-huh. You know, suddenly this individual who basically doesn't necessarily have experience doing this is now responsible for a problem that's kind of significantly scaled up from where they thought they would have to solve. I think kind of setting some constraints around that so you kind of can prove that you're responsible with the resources of the backers at sort of a smaller scale and work your way upward. Sure. From there, I think that might be something, I don't know, that they might want to think about.
Yeah, and I understand, well, because sort of the big picture is that's a lot of money. But then I always sort of come back to it and say, well, but each individual backer is not really putting that much money into it. I mean, when in the long run. So as to, I guess the trade-off is, do we put these extra protections in that can kind of maybe stifle people who want to, you know, have more successful projects, or you know, do you want to put limits on things? I don't know. I have maybe more of a libertarian view on this, where it's like, okay, people are in control over their money. They can do whatever they want with it. You know, the information is there. You know, they haven't done a project before. You know, this could completely get screwed up and you could lose your money, but you know, it's $50. So if your $50 that you put in for the game or $80 is going to break the bank, you probably shouldn't be doing it in the first place. But as an individual, that's your responsibility, right? To make that decision. I don't know.
Yeah, I've thought a lot about it from that perspective too. And one of the, I think it ultimately trickles to be a little bigger than that, in the sense that it only takes one or two times of getting burned to turn a person off from crowdfunding altogether.
Sure.
So in the short term, it definitely makes sense, right? The individual is responsible for their choices, but then what ends up happening is if you sort of have this unbounded experience repeatedly, now you're sort of burning off these people permanently once they sort of gamble and lose, in a sense, right? And
right.
You know, that's not in the best interest of Kickstarter, and it's also not in the best interest of all of the other legitimate project runners.
Right. Right. In fact, it's in no one's best interest. I can't think of anyone that would benefit from that.
Right.
Collection agencies, maybe? I don't know. Okay. So obviously, a balance, I think, would be the best way to do it. There's got to be some sort of interference, but maybe it's just an education thing, right? So maybe Kickstarter implements, I mean, they do have a lot of educational materials, but a lot of the stuff that's sort of game specific, like, I don't know, maybe they do talk about not having the scope of your project be too big and all of that. I don't know. I haven't gone through the process, but anyway.
Yeah.
Cool. I don't know. It's not an easy answer.
It reminds me, hopefully this is interesting. It reminds me of, there's, I don't know if it's a parable or a fable or however you want to say it, but there's a guy who he's raffling off a horse, and he says one ticket to win this horse is $2, and kind of goes to the whole town and collects his $2 and then picks one winner, and he gives them the horse, and the horse is dead. And the guy says, you know, you never said the horse was dead. And he's like, he said, sorry about that. Here's your $2 back. And so it kind of reminded me of that when you said, you know, each individual is kind of taking on this small
right,
risk.
Right. Well, and you're right. I guess, you know, there's an argument on both sides that definitely has merit. But anyway, so that was sort of an aside, but let's talk a little bit about how you do your business. So what's the mix of games that you've designed versus games that are from other designers that you've published?
Yeah, my first couple games that I published were my own designs. Mm-hmm. Legacy Gears of Time was the first one. Mm-hmm. It's a card game about time travel and technology. You're building up elaborate chains of technologies while traveling backward through time. It's kind of a brain twisty, hand management, take that style game. Got really good reception, especially for the time. My second project was Epic Resort. It's a deck evolution and worker placement game where you're building a resort for fantasy heroes. It's got a nice little following to it. And just last year, I published the first expansion for that one. It's called Villains Vacation, where the bad guys decide it's their turn to get some rest. In 2015, I decided to branch out a little bit and got to know John Gilmore of Dead of Winter and recently Dinosaur Island and whatnot fame. And he had put together a nice little game called that we ended up calling Vault Wars, which is a bidding and bluffing game about auctioning off the vaults that belong to fallen heroes. I'm not a huge, I'm not a huge fan of auction games, but as soon as I played this, it was fantastic. And I said, I have to play this. So, and so I kind of took that game and, fitted into the world of Epic Resort that I was building out there. So kind of has that sort of cheeky angle to what do heroes do in their off time or, you know, what happens when they die, where does all their stuff go, and whatnot. And then most recently, that's coming out right now is called Sagrada. That's a game designed by Daryl Andrews and Adrian Adamescu. It's a dice drafting game where you're building stained glass windows. So it's got a really fun, puzzly feel to it. And it's really colorful and bright. Looks great on the table. Yeah, a lot of fun.
Interesting theme. I'd never heard of anything like that before, but that's very cool. So that's a pretty, I mean, you have a pretty good mix of different types of games, different types of themes. How do you decide what you want to add to your catalog? Do you sort of have a vision of what a Floodgate game is and then try to pick things that fit into that? Or do you just say, this is really awesome, I want to publish this, you know?
Yeah, I feel like there's a common thread amongst the games that I choose to publish. I'm struggling to articulate how to express what that is. And this is a problem I've had for years now is, just kind of forming that thought and how do I express that? The best I can come up with is I love games where the theme and mechanics blend, as seamlessly as possible so that you just really get into the game and the escapism of the experience and, games that have a good story arc to them where there's sort of a well-defined beginning, middle, and end, I think that's a really important aspect of the games that I choose to play and publish. It just really solidifies the experience and really makes it meaningful and creates memories for people, I think.
I agree. Do you have plans to publish your own designs from now on, or do you think you've sort of transitioned into the publisher role now?
Oh, man, great question. I really enjoy playing the publisher and developer role and handling those aspects. Mm-hmm. That being said, I've got a whole backlog of ideas I'd love to get out of my head and then onto paper and onto cards and such. But yeah, time is not on my side in those terms. Yeah, and as I've been growing the company, I've gotten the attention of more and more independent designers, and frankly, I've just seen a lot of really solid designs. And, you know, I'm so tempted to just take, like, my pipeline is full of games I love playing.
Right.
And I, like, why even sit to design my own when I have
so many
like,
great games out there, right? Yeah.
Ready to great go. Games out there and great games that, that I've seen that, I'm planning on publishing as well. Yeah. So it's kind of hard to turn off that tap, which is a good problem to have.
Yeah, most definitely. So are you doing Floodgate Games running it full time, or do you have separate job? I'm always curious about
Yeah,
this.
not yet full time, so
Okay.
I'm Iron Manning right now.
What kind of work do you do, if you don't mind me asking?
Oh no, that's perfectly fine.
Is it
I work in
business?
IT. I manage a
Okay.
team of software developers.
Okay. Very cool. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Do you find that that kind of work helps you in the game work, or are they pretty different?
I think functionally they're pretty different, but in terms of understanding systems in abstract, I think really helps. So that's a large portion of what I do for my day job. And also I think that's sort of a component that overlays both game design and sort of the interactions of different entities within the gaming industry. So I draw a lot of parallels there. I feel like it really helps with sort of the procedural nature of rule books and game rules and being able to say, like, how do I cover all these edge cases? And am I consistent with terminology? And, like, is this sort of a tight rule set such that it doesn't have, leaky aspects to it or anything like that?
Right. Well, my job has similar issues, right? You want to try to, create a closed loop on contracts and things like that, and remove sort of the externalities that could ruin the whole deal and all of that. It's usually impossible to do. Just like with rules, there's always going to be something that, there wouldn't be all these Board Game Geek forums about rules clarifications if it was that easy. But
Layers and layers of clarification and
absolutely.
sort of speculation and interpretation, and then you introduce the sort of like English is not my first language aspect to it, and that opens up a whole new world of complications as well.
Yeah, I mean, when even the biggest in the business have rules, addendums, and errata and things on their websites, then you know that it's sort of a losing game to try to get it perfect.
Yeah, for sure. Well, the crowd will help us get there
Yeah,
then.
exactly. Well, I mean, and so do you find that that's helpful? So when you run a Kickstarter, do you put the rules up and sort of crowdsource it like that? Have people run through it, maybe a print and play version of the game? Do you do that in your Kickstarter campaigns?
Yeah, I love sharing the rules, because I do want people to get a sense of the game. I try to put my best effort forward, and my expectation is not that I'm relying on the crowd to edit the rule book or anything like that, but I treat it as a great test, sort of one of toward the end. By the time I'm running a Kickstarter project, the rules have already been sort of closed play tested and then open play tested and blind play tested as well. So by that time, I feel like they've been pretty well vetted, as well as often edited by that time, but not always. So, but people are creative and find things, or when you open it up to this broader audience, international audience especially, you get a lot of questions around clarifications, and people are incredibly generous with their time and attention. It's phenomenal the amount of effort people put toward volunteer toward helping make a project better.
That's
I
something pretty common that, I hear from
couldn't do it without them.
a lot of developers and publishers that, the people out there. I mean, you're working in something that they love, so it's obviously they're gonna be okay with putting their time in, and that's great. So that's what makes this industry
Absolutely.
awesome. Absolutely.
I agree.
So tell me a bit about your playtesting process. How does that go? From your initial prototype or your idea to actually getting it in the hands of players. I'm interested
Yeah,
how that works.
every project is unique. I try to approach playtesting in the way that I think makes the most sense for each of the games. Based on its complexity and how easy it is to deliver components and such to players, and honestly too, what I feel the market is for the game, just to kind of get it out there and whatnot. Vault Wars was probably the most structured playtest that we did. We had a fairly formal process where that John and I kind of co-invented, where we ran a private subreddit for conversations and delivered print and play materials via Dropbox, and then took feedback via Google Forms and kind of amalgamated all that in this feedback loop, where people would play and they'd record their plays and then we'd feed that back in and get them new materials and keep the versioning up to date and just kind of cycled over that. And I think we ended up doing 12 iterations, just really getting the balance right and mm-hmm. getting feedback on wording and what's interesting, what's not, and all of that. And that was just a awesome experience and a lot of fun. Great feedback from everyone. Feedback not only about the game, but just about the experience as well.
Yeah.
So I recommend that if the game is conducive to it. I do a lot of what I call like static analysis too, where you kind of take all of the numeric aspects of the game and ensure that they're balanced. And sometimes you attribute a quantitative value to qualitative things.
Sure.
Say like, this is a strong ability or whatnot. And then sort of get your averages and see what your cost benefit is for each particular component and whatnot, to be able to just kind of have this other angle where you can keep things in check. You can't rely on it altogether, and it's tricky to find the sort of the unit of the game to understand
right.
what to compare to what, but
right.
it can be really rewarding as well.
It's got to be more difficult than, so let's say you were making a fighting video game, like Street Fighter type of game, and you can basically put that out in the wild, people play it, and you get some hard data from that, and you can, you know, release patches and sort of patch it up and tweak it as you go if something's overpowered or whatever. But with a tabletop game, once you put it out there, you kind of are stuck with what you have, right?
You got it. Yeah, you have to be certain. Yeah. More certain that video gaming has to because of the distribution model, of course,
yeah.
right?
Like, yeah, definitely.
This is a physical component that's you're going to hold in your hand, and it's really difficult to push an update to that.
Yeah, I mean, you can never be sure that if you put something on your website that just says, "Well, this card should be, you know, 2 gold instead of 3 gold or something like that." You know, who knows if people are going to see it?
Yeah. Fortunately. What's interesting, it seems like the people who care the most mm-hmm. are going to look for it the hardest.
Yeah.
So I think there is value in making it available. You don't just sort of throw up your hands and say, well, we screwed up and that's it.
Right.
I think that's where forums like BoardGameGeek still have a lot of value, where you can say, oh, no, yeah, this does make more sense. So let's sort of make it official and we'll include it in the next print run and so on. But if you want to play with it this way or that way, feel free.
Right. Have you ever had a situation where you wanted to send out a replacement card or something like that to people that have bought it? I don't know. That seems like a huge pain, but
nothing that made it into the print run where I sort of had that regret.
Yeah.
I have made changes and tweaks from first printing to second printing a couple mm-hmm. times. Actually, in all three of Legacy, Epic Resort, and Vault Wars have had those tweaks, but. Nothing that was broken to the point where it needed a desperate fix or anything like that.
Okay. Good. Congratulations.
<That's good> to know. Oh, it'll happen. I'm sure. I'm
Someday. For
the shoe yeah. drop. That's right.
How many games do you generally have kind of working on at one time?
It's kind of had this hockey stick curve if we plot it over time. So
yeah.
As of right now, I have got about, I would say 5 wow. games/expansions that are in the pipeline. And I'm planning through pretty much through the end of next year, at this point, which is a year ago, I was maybe 2 games in. So I think it's been
yeah,
definitely ramping up quite a bit.
Very cool. That's awesome. So you aren't doing this full time. Do you feel like there's a transition point, a tipping point where you want to do this full time, or do you think that the situation is pretty good right now? And this is how you want to balance your life and your business.
Yeah, I think things are good right now. I'm very fortunate that I love what I do for my day job as well as the publishing side of my life. So it's a little hard to leave something you love for something sure. you love. Right.
Yeah.
So
Something that's
There's
probably a
definitely
more guaranteed paycheck as well, right? Than
yeah. The stability is nice, of course.
Absolutely. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess the question is, when you get to the point where it's too much work, right? Do you either go full time or do you hire someone on, bring someone on to sort of take that? I guess I don't know. Do you want to? Is it worth the money to pay someone to sort of handle the problem for you, doing maybe just doing some logistics things or updating the Kickstarter or whatever? Like, do you go into crazy Kickstarter mode and have trouble doing your full time job when you're running a campaign, or do you have help? I don't know. I've heard it's sort of an all encompassing thing to run a Kickstarter campaign.
It can be, all of the above. I kind of plan for it with the rest of my life so that I'm, you see it coming and you kind of make everyone aware around you, like brace for impact. I might be gone for a while. So there's that aspect to it. And yeah, it takes a village too. I've got a lot of great friends that contribute a lot of their time and effort to
Awesome.
making everything as magical as it ends up being. And that's everything from play testing and advice and just listening to me ramble on about games all the way through answering questions on BGG or helping out during the Kickstarter projects to help answer questions in the comments area and the like.
Awesome. Yeah, well, that's good. You're not alone then. That's good to know. What about
Yeah, definitely.
like digital versions of your games? Have you ever thought about doing that? Moving into
Yeah,
iPads and I don't know, PC games.
I've looked at quite a bit of the other publishers and kind of how things have gone, and it's that one's a tough one for me to make the leap into. I mean, I'm curious about it and fascinated, and I would love to have all of our games have digital versions, but there's a really big sunk cost to that,
Yeah,
and
for sure.
It's difficult to take those risks at this point, I think.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the market is like for tabletop games specifically. I know the mobile game market is ridiculous. I mean, you think there's a lot of tabletop games coming out, but mobile games, it's just like 500 or more apps every day going out of app
Wow.
stores. Yeah, it's insane. So, much like Kickstarter, where it's just super crowded and you have to sort of do your own work to market it, it's very similar with mobile games. In fact, it's even worse. And so in mobile games, you can either sort of organically have a hit, which is really difficult, just like with tabletop games, or you can basically pay to acquire users, which is how a lot of, funded mobile games do it, right? They're paying a certain,
Sure.
and so you have to pay a certain amount of money, and you have to be sure that your game is set up to extract at least that amount of money out of on average from each person, which is,
Yeah.
I mean, it's a totally different market, but if you're going to go into that, you kind of have to go into it with a much different mindset than if you were just publishing the tabletop game.
Yeah, I think the social, like sharing aspects of mobile games seem to contribute quite a bit to their success. Like if it's really easy for me to say this game's great, I want to play it with my friends, or it's easy to share with my friends so that they can have a similar experience. I think we get a lot of those parallels in tabletop gaming, but it feels like the experience is so much heavier that it's difficult to have that sharing translate into, from a publisher perspective, into another sale or into another direct customer. Which I think it's interesting to me because it's so much more of a social activity often to play a tabletop game with your friends versus a mobile game. But it doesn't it but the sort of viral social aspect of it end up being inverted from that just because of the distribution and I think weight of the experience.
Sure. And I mean, you get one physical copy of it, and that's probably enough for your friends, right? Whereas with mobile games, each friend has to have their own copy, and then it's like you say, it's very seamless to just sort of share it on Facebook or post these updates that people can see, and then click a button and they're downloading one too. Very different with physical products.
Definitely, definitely.
Okay, so Let's talk about conventions and marketing and all of that before. So do you go to a lot of conventions during the year? I saw there you have a little schedule on your website, and there's one, it looks like one every month. But that might be outdated, but is that
Yeah,
how you do it?
I try to get to as many as my time allows. I think I'm averaging about 5 to 7 either conventions or trade shows throughout the year. Most recently, I was at Gamma in Las Vegas, and I'll be at ACD Games Day. But both of those are more of the trade show kind of business side of things. In terms of the sort of in gamer facing conventions, Gen Con's the next big one that we'll be at. But I also have a friend helping me out. He's going to be running a tournament for Sagrada at Dice Tower Con. So
Great.
that'll be my first experience kind of branching out and having someone help out remotely at a convention I won't be at, which is interesting.
That's yeah, that's the big transition into, becoming like a real sort of a, I don't know, not so much a one-man show, but like a, it feels more real. Like you're like, okay, you minion, go and do this, and then you go and do that, and you become, you're now you're the boss, right? Yeah, I'm debating whether or not to go to, I know I'm gonna end up going to Gen Con, but it's just such a, like where I am right now, I've been traveling so much in the first half of this year that I just sort of want to take a break. But and I've got plans to go to, like I said, PAX Unplugged, and then PAX Australia as well.
Oh, wow.
And Casual Connect is in Singapore next month. I mean, there's just so much. Actually, this may come out next month, so it could be, it could have happened already. But yeah, I don't know. But Gen Con is the best. I love going there. I always have a great
It's
time.
so much
So
fun.
it's going to be hard to, even with a 14, 20-hour flight that I have to do.
Well, I hope you make it, if anything, so I can at least wave to you briefly, because that's about all the interaction and time I get
Yeah,
with
exactly.
anybody I want to.
Do you do so you I met you on the panel, like we said, at PAX South, but do you do a lot of panels and things like that, or do you find that that isn't really worth your time? Your time's better spent in the booth selling games.
At Gen Con, I spend the majority of my time in the booth, just making sure things run smoothly and answering the edge questions that the rest of my folks can't answer, and just interfacing with all the various industry folks who want to meet with you. But in terms of being on panels, I love that experience, and the few opportunities I've had have been fantastic, and I'm really open to that when the opportunities present themselves, for sure.
Okay, well, maybe I'll invite you in August. We'll see. I did a ton of panels last year, and it was really fun, but I didn't have much time for anything else. So I think I'm gonna sort of pull it back a little bit this year and just enjoy the convention, actually play some games this time, which could be fun.
Yeah, you have such an interesting niche for yourself. I'm sure people are really fascinated in what you have to say.
Yeah, and I've thought about and with a colleague of mine, sort of getting a booth or doing something like that to, if we have a lot of designers walking around. I think Gen Con maybe is not the place to do any kind of that, thing like that, because there's too many players there. It's mostly players. But if we're looking for one that's more developer focused and people that would actually benefit from, from talking to me and having me there.
Yeah, maybe something like Protospiel or Unpub might be a better fit, although that's sort of swinging all the way to the other end of the sort of life cycle of a game idea.
Sure, but I think sometimes it's good to have someone like me on the team, even if you're not paying me to do things at the, at that point. There's a lot of, I generally will not, micromanage and charge for everything. So if you have some general questions, we can get the process started so that, I think my strategy as a lawyer and a business person is I want to sort of support people when they're just starting out, because then eventually things get rolling. And if I can help them be successful, even with the little bits of advice or whatever, eventually their success means that that's more work for me. And that's someone that's actually going to be a great client. Not that they're not great clients when they're just starting out, but, obviously as a business person, I'm looking for regular work and, someone that's really going to be a great client. And I think a lot of them are. And the more I can help them in the beginning, the more chance that there's going to be that they're going to be an awesome client as we go through the process together.
And I can vouch for the non-micromanagement, non nitpicky aspect of being one of your clients. So
okay,
definitely appreciate that.
I appreciate the kind words.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, most clients appreciate sort of, okay, this is going to cost you this much. I'm not going to, you know, bill every minute of an email and all that. I'll just sort of give you a flat fee and work from there. That's usually, and that's the way the whole legal industry is going, really. Just, you know, you want this legal service, you want that, instead of paying, you know, a $10,000 retainer and then just anything I do, I draw from that retainer. I think that's, sure. You know, for huge companies, that's fine. But I think, the way things are now, it's definitely that's going away.
So. Yeah, it makes it a lot easier to budget around and understand how my legal costs impact my profitability and
right. The
viability of a project when it's not as muddied in this sort of hourly rate quagmire. Yeah. And wondering if you like is asking you a question or a clarification going to like blow up my budget and that whole thing. It's very nice.
Usually, yeah. I mean, my general practice is if I'm going to have to charge you for something, I'll say, if you ask me a question and then I will reply and say, look, I would need to research that and I'd have to bill you for that. But I'm not going to just go do it and then send you a bill. You're wondering why you get a, you know, $800 bill because I had to look into something. So you just casually asked a question. Yeah, it doesn't seem fair.
It's almost like you treat people like a reasonable human being.
Almost. We're not all terrible people, as lawyers. Yeah. In fact, most of them are very cool. I think anyone that's actually worked with lawyers, at least in this business or in any business really, finds that we're quite charming. But you know, you see us on TV and the ones that make the news are usually the a-holes that are the ones that you don't want to work with. Anyway, so about legal stuff. So I love trademarks. That's a good part of my practice. So, I mean, one of the big things with trademarks is just dealing with the process of naming a game, right? So when you're naming a game, first of all, what is the process like? How do you sort of come up with a name? And then do you take trademarks into consideration when you're doing that?
Yeah. So historically, if I could even say that, for my first few games, it was really the main considerations were, you know, does this name, is it catchy and mm-hmm. is it marketable and does it capture the theme and sort of all of the creative outward facing aspects of it. And then also, of course, what's it look like in relative to other things in the marketplace for is there confusion introduced and whatnot. But that was about the extent. And with Sagrada, I think because this is I felt was going to be sort of the biggest game in terms of exposure and mm-hmm. whatnot, and sort of the most liable, if it's fair to say that. That's where I kind of wanted to get involved with chatting with you about trademarking on that and everything. So that's been the most formal that I've had so far, and so far the process has been great, and I've appreciated all of your help and guidance there. And
thank you.
I think it can make sense. There is definitely an expense to it, and it's about weighing the value of that cost versus the benefits you'll get from how popular you think the game will be.
Sure. And you know, it's sort of a catch 22 because with trademarks, you want to get a registration in as soon as you sort of finalize the fact that, okay, I want this name. Sagrada is the name of this game. So you want to, you know, plant your flag on that trademark, doing what's called an intent to use trademark before you've even started marketing or selling the game. But again, you don't know. I mean, you're putting in, you know, sometimes as much as $1,000 or whatever in a trademark before you even know if the game's going to sell. So it's a little difficult. And I know that there have been discussions on one of those Facebook groups. I think the game publishing Facebook group, I think James Matthew runs, but mm-hmm. he definitely takes the opinion that it's probably never worth it to, unless you know that something's a big hit, to go out and trademark the game. Which I understand, I get it, but obviously from my perspective, better safe than sorry, right? So if you start marketing your game, you start marketing Sagrada, right, in January, but you're not actually selling it yet, you haven't accrued any rights to that name, really, from a trademark perspective. So if in March someone else releases a game called Sagrada, you're kind of screwed because you can't stop them from doing it because you haven't actually sold a product under that name or accrued any trademark rights. So now you have to go back, change your marketing, and deal with all of that. So it's a problem. That's the issue. And with a name like Sagrada, I think it's actually a great trademark because it's very unique, very distinctive. There was only one other when we were searching, there was only mm-hmm. one other registered trademark with that name, and it was for something completely different, so that's what I'm looking for from a trademark perspective. It's something very distinct like that. So good job. Maybe intuitively you thought of that, but I approve. I approve of your choice.
Very good. And, you know, I've seen a couple projects who've struggled with, you know, kind of butting heads when it comes to previously trademarked games and have had to, like, mid campaign or even post campaign, change the name of their game. And that I think getting ahead of the ball can definitely prevent a snafu like that. And, you know, that sort of that up to $1,000 that it costs to file a trademark includes the research to detect whether or not you're going to have a problem like that. So
right. At least with, you know, it's not with everyone, but yeah, sure.
That's part of it. Yeah. And that's what I've found, yeah. I guess from my single experience on it. But to me, I almost see it as not only sort of that forward protection, but sort of the backward insurance too, where it's like, oh, early on I can detect this problem and pivot. Yep. Before we market hard on this game and whatnot.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree. I mean, even if you don't want to pay the filing fee, it's sometimes worth it to just do the clearance search beforehand and make sure that at least at that moment in time, things are okay to go forward with that name. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
All right. We are at the end of our time. Ben, it was great having you on. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, of course. Really great. Thanks for the great questions.
No problem. Where can our listeners find you?
Floodgategames.com or I'm always on Twitter, so @floodgategames.
Okay.
Excellent. Hit me up there.
Easy. Very easy. Well, you can find me at gamelawyerblog.com. You can read more about the legal aspects of game development there. And I will see everyone hopefully next month. I've been very erratic with posting podcasts, but I'm going to try. I always say this, but I'm going to try and keep more on a monthly schedule. That's it. All right. I'm going to cut it off there.